Hear that? It's the sound of someone whacking the ground with a rake. Specifically, they're beating around the bush, which we've done enough of in this ad too, so let's get right to it. The new Moneymaker scratch-off from the Ohio Lottery doesn't beat around the bush. Moneymaker. Play the game and you could win money. Up to $2 million. With more than $88 million in prizes, ranging from $50 to $500, Moneymaker cuts right to the cash. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Hello and welcome to Backlisted, a brand new podcast that gives old books a second chance. I'm John Mitchinson, and he's Andy Miller. We're readers, writers, and editors of books. We are the Leavis and Butthead of the book world, but which is which, only you can decide. We're coming to you from the kitchen table of Unbound, the website where readers and writers meet to create great books. We're joined today by Lissa Evans, the acclaimed novelist and producer of Father Ted, and Matthew Clayton, a rather less acclaimed writer and producer of Tenuous Literary Links, as you'll discover later. Andy, what have you been reading?
This week? Or generally?
Andy, what have you been reading this week?
I've read several books this week. The first book that I finished this week was the 900 pages of Life and Fate by Vasily Grossman, a novel I've been meaning to read for 20 years, ever since you, John Mitchinson, gave me a copy.
It's a bulging, rippling Russian masterpiece, isn't it? It takes you high, it takes you low, it takes you from all angles.
It's the it's an entirely inappropriate subject for lightheartedness, John, if you don't mind me saying.
It's true. It's an amazing novel, though, isn't it? Proper.
It's one absolutely wonderful book. It is a quite consciously, I think, modelled on War and Peace, and attempts to tell you the story of Stalingrad, the siege of Stalingrad in the Second World War, but also by the extension, the rise of Stalin prior to the Second World War, through the Second World War and out the other side, by giving you a massive cast of characters, all of whom have ludicrously long Russian names, throwing down about 50 of them in the first 30 pages, and then begging you to keep up. But if you stick with it, as is often the case with these long books, it really, really delivers. I have to say, about the 500-page mark, I found it incredibly moving.
This is your thesis, though. This is your Year of Reading Dangerously, Read Yourself Fitter thesis, that these big books, if you can only just stick at it, you'll actually end up not only having a great experience, but become a better person.
Yes. In a nutshell, yes. I don't think all books are there to entertain you all the way through. And I tend to think that a book will give you back what you put into it a lot of the time. Not all the time. But certainly I found with Life and Fate that once you'd done the groundwork and once you were prepared to let the author do some work on your behalf, the payback was totally worth it. Brilliant book.
Excellent.
Well, I was reading that. What were you reading?
Well, I was reading this, Hate Mail by Mr. Bingo. And it's brilliant because it's really quick to read because it's basically just a book of postcards.
Oh, that's nice.
And the premise of the postcards is that he asked people to pay him to send them rude, abusive postcards. And it is, I have to say, one of the funniest things I've ever read. And better than that, as you can see, Dear Matt, you are a loser and have a fat back. Love Mr. Bingo. Or the one I particularly love is there's a circle with Ronald McDonald on one side and another circle with Hitler's face on another. And where they intersect like a Venn diagram, it just says you. it's just really, he's a brilliant illustrator. You were a effing ugly baby, dear Lily. You were, and then a really, really ugly baby face.
I must say to the listeners, it is beautifully a designed book with a grey cover, the format of which reminds me strongly of Martin Parr's brilliant boring postcards.
It has got that. Dear Jude, you have a tiny brain. And there's a great picture of it. Anyway, the point is...
Do you want to just read out the whole book? I'll read out Life and Fate. You can read that out, yeah.
Well, it is a fat book, like Life and Fate.
It is.
But I think, and beautifully produced, but it is obviously meant for the smallest room in the house. But the reason I really love it, Mr. Bingo put a Kickstarter campaign out for this book and raised massive amount, about £140,000, I think. And I was just amused. I thought you would be amused too by the things that you could pay for. I mean, it's basically you paid £50 to get an abusive postcard. I liked it. He said that the beautiful book that we see in front of us would be equally at home next to your toilet or on display in a twatty, chin-stroking art gallery, which I think has a ring of truth about it. But he said there are other things you could do. You could be told to F off on the internet for £18, or you could get the opportunity to get shit-faced on a train with Mr. Bingo for £150. He says, I really like drinking on trains. I'll be splitting them into groups of five at a time, so if I end up filling all 20 places, I'll lay them all out and organise them into groups that I think might work with each other. A bit like that bit on The X Factor when the judges put ultimate boy and girl bands together for drifting entrance. At the top end, you can enjoy a pint with Mr. Bingo in 5 years' time for £200. Anyway, I like it. His final perk, it's reinforced the notion that people really like paying good money to be told to fuck off. It also restores my faith in humanity, he says. People are funnier and sillier than I thought. Mr. Bingo, hate mail.
How much did he have to raise to make the book happen?
He only had to raise about 30,000, so he raised more than 100,000 more. That's an amazing thing. £100,000
wow.
Extra, because people love being told to go and stick their heads up their backside.
My tenuous fact on this is that what I think is amazing about it is, firstly, the fuck octopus, which is on the cover, which you can't see, but I urge you to go onto the internet and look at it.
It's an octopus flicking the V's eight times.
And it's beautifully embossed on this beautiful grey. It's a lovely book, isn't it?
So that's kind of fact one. Fact two is that he raised this incredible amount of money from a relatively small amount of people. So it's from 3,500 people. If he'd sold 3,500 copies in the shops, he would have maybe made £3,500. By doing it via Kickstarter, he's made like £80,000. I think that's really interesting.
And how does he feel? I have friends who've Kickstarted books, and they delight themselves by thinking of unlikely targets or challenges that people then pay for that he then has to go through with. How does he feel about drinking on trains?
I think he said he loves drinking on trains. So it's something he does anyway. So he's only doing what he would do normally.
And he loves telling people to fuck off as well. So yeah.
Well, he's monetarised one dream after another, hasn't he? Yeah. Superb.
He has. I particularly like this. Dear Rob, no Instagram filters will save your face. Love, Mr. Bingo. But enough of this, Andy. What else have you got in your pile of masterpieces?
Well, I've also been reading... simultaneously... both Naked Lunch by William Burroughs and Love in a Cold Climate by Nancy Mitford. And what I've been trying to do...
I'd say almost identical, so it must be...
It must be difficult to distinguish. It's all becoming one book, The Exploits of Lord Mugwump. But I was wondering whether you read two books on the go.
Always. Can't possibly read one. And I alternate all the time. I read different books at different times of day. I mean, I think, you know, there's a morning book, usually something a little bit about nature, just gets me into the day. But if I'm reading serious fiction, that has to be kind of, you know, I need a coffee. Needs to be the middle of the day. Or what I find is last thing at night where I get, you know, I like to read things that keep me awake.
See, I much prefer not to. I much prefer
just
to stick to one book. Yeah. And, really, it was just my favourite time to read in the day is 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock in the morning before the world has woken up and wants stuff from me. And I can just concentrate. But I was finding the experience of reading Naked Lunch at 5 o'clock in the morning a bit of a downer. So I decided to tag team with Nancy Mitford. I was trying to think who would be more appalled by that coupling, Mitford or Burroughs.
Oh, I think Mitford was pretty unshockable. I think Burroughs would have found it.
Burroughs would be horrified.
Horrified, yes.
Absolutely horrified, yeah.
Have
you read both those books?
I have not read both of them.
You read either of them?
I've not read either of them.
Congratulations.
There are huge gaps in my reading. That's the whole point about what we're trying to do with this
one,
podcast.
One is a comedy of society manners.
Yeah.
And the other is the Nancy Mitford.
Oh, ka-ching. Yeah. What I think we're trying to do is to promote generally the fact that, A, reading is good for you, but B, don't tell lies about what you haven't read. So I think that is the absolute. We will never come in here and talk knowledgeably about books that we've never read. So that's the backlisted promise. The seal. What, do you want to hear about my next book that I've been reading?
Yes.
This is completely different. This is called A Cotswold Village, and it was published in 1900s. It's by J. Arthur Gibbs. And it's a rather sad story because it's a really lovely book, but he died at the age of 31, literally just before the book was published. So it was published posthumously, and it's rather sweet. He's got his wife in here, who I think it's his wife or his sister, just saying, you know, what a lovely man he was. And what did he say? She said something really nice about him, which I now can't find. Yes, he had a deep love for things that are lovely, pure, and of good report. But the best thing about it is there's a guy in it who is the hero of the book, who is a gamekeeper called Tom Peregrine, who he translates all his talk and in the way they write dialogue. This is rather like the book we're coming on to talk to in a minute. Dialogue is quite difficult to put into prose, but he does it brilliantly. And by the end of it, Tom Peregrine's become this hero. And not only is a hero, there's a very funny story where he goes in, he's told to get some oxtail soup in town, and he comes back with some oxalic soap. And his wife insists on making it into a soup. And when he says it tastes, this don't taste right, my love, my lover, she makes him eat it all because, A, she said, you know, anything that's a soup has got to be good for you. And B, they'd already spent the money on it. But
Does he die?
He doesn't die.
Because that doesn't look like it's near the end of the book, actually.
The book is this great thing. Tom Peregrine, here we go. Tom Peregrine suddenly appears out of a hedge where he'd been watching the antics of the cubs at the mouth of the Fox Earth. He's grown very serious of late and tells you repeatedly that there's going to be another big European war shortly. And he said, let us hope his gloomy forebodings are doomed to disappointment. Surely, surely, at the end of this marvellous 19th century, when there are so many men in the world who've learnt the difficult lessons of life in a way that they've never learnt before, nations are no longer obliged to behave like children, or worse still, with their petty jealousies and bickerings and growlings, like dogs that delight to bark and bite.
Oh, that's
Gibbs, dead, 1900, 14 years later, all went into...
Well, it's the middle of the Boer War when he died.
Tom Peregrine, his finger was on some weird poles. It's called A Cotswold Village by J. Arthur Gibbs.
I haven't read that, before you ask.
No.
Well, how did you come to that?
Well, this is my morning routine. I like to read books about country pursuits and nature and things that make me feel kind of warm and cuddly, like you early in the morning. I love to get up and read early in the morning. Mm-hmm. And these are the kind of things I find them in secondhand bookshops, Andy.
It's an exclusive club of people who wrote books and then died before they were published. And one I can think of is Giuseppe de Lampedusa's The Leopard.
One of the great books.
I always think it's so unfair. He didn't get any of that glory, did he?
Oh, Emily Dickinson, just putting them all in a drawer.
She never even sought publication there.
A great favourite of mine. Have you ever heard of this? The Journal of a Disappointed Man.
Oh, yes.
By W.N.P. Barbellion. That's a wonderful book.
I haven't.
It's basically a man feeling very sorry for himself in the early 20th century. What happens to him is he goes to the doctor to try and get out of being conscripted, and the army doctor, and his GP gives him a letter and says, oh, give this to the army doctor when you get there. So he trots along to the army doctor, hands the letter over. The army doctor reads the letter, doesn't tell him what's in it, and says, oh, well, that's okay, Mr. Barbellion. You can go home. No need to fight in the First World War for you. So on the omnibus on the way home, he opens up the letter to see what's in it. And it says, Mr. Barbellion is suffering from the early stages of multiple sclerosis.
Oh, God.
So the second half of the book is about him coping with an actual thing he has to feel sorry for. And it is the most wonderful funny, brave, humbling thing to read. Someone who has the kind of self-pity that presumably a lot of us have 100 years ago, suddenly being given something to cope with and rising to the challenge. And I think I'm right in saying it was published, I don't think it was published after his death, but it was published when he was very near the end.
So it's like Seasons in the Sun.
Like Seasons in the Sun.
We had joy. We had fun.
Yeah. And I can hear WMP Barbellion spinning in his grave.
you know what though? The king of the crap link. We had joy, we had fun, we had Seasons in the Sun. Doesn't that remind you of JL Carr's A Month in the Country?
It does.
Not quite perfect, but that is the book
Smooth.
That we are talk about today on this podcast mostly.
Okay, it's time now for an advert. About a year ago, I had finished one of these long Russian novels, which is my delight and duty to read. And I asked a few people on Twitter, right, I've just finished this book. I'd really like to read, so recommend me something. It's short, something that, that I can just connect with quickly and enjoy. And several people said, A Month in the Country by J.L. Carr. Since which time I've noticed it's a book that on Twitter people talk about a lot. It's the equivalent of Twitter word of mouth. And word of mouth, as we know, is always the thing that actually sells books.
So it's like a sort of literary cat gif. Is that what you say? Just comes up again and again.
A poignant cat gif.
And it's worked because it's been republished. Presumably that's the tailor's wagged the dog on this occasion.
And the reason why we asked Liz is to come in and... share this experience of talking about A Month in the Country with us is partly because she, I believe, is one of the people who responded to me and said, have you ever read A Month in the Country by J.L. Carr? I think you'd love it. But also, Lissa, author of 4 novels for adults, 2 novels for children, your last couple of adults' novels, Their Finest Hour and a Half and Crooked Heart, are both... they're funny, they're very touching, they evoke... a time and a specific place, which is one of the things that A Month in the Country does. What are the challenges for somebody who wants to bring a time and a place to life in a novel?
For me, it's being comfortable in the era. So you're not an observer, you're an inhabitant of it. Otherwise, you don't want to be wandering around noting Bakelite radios and spotting things which people living in the era wouldn't have bothered to spot because they were part of the era. You need to be totally comfortable in it. You need to be comfortable with the vocabulary, with what you would see, with the way people's conversations ran. And that for me is how it works. It is doing so much research that you don't need to bother to do anymore because you understand how people thought then. So any plot you think of works because it's how things were.
It's like an actor learning their lines to the point where they can forget their lines and just inhabit the...
I think that's true. That's for me, anyway.
And is that one of the things that you think works about A Month in the Country?
Yes, but then everything works about A Month in the Country. it starts off, the first page is a man of 20 called Tom Birkin in 1920 getting off a train in a Yorkshire village called Oxgodby. Actually, he's not 20, he's 23, isn't he? A Yorkshire village called Oxgodby in the pouring rain. And it ends with him leaving the village of Oxgodby around about 2 months later. It's never very clear. He gets there in July. He leaves probably
slightly
in September.
Misleading title is.
Yes, it's not a month in the country at all. But then the month in the middle of it is the perfect month. Yeah. Birkin is a veteran of the First World War, and he's there to do a job. A local benefactress has left money to the church, but... the church will only get the money if a wall painting she suspects is there. In fact, she knows it's there because she scraped off part of the lime wash. If a wall painting is exposed and if the grave of her ancestor, who died in the 15th century and was weirdly excommunicated, if the grave of the ancestor is searched for. So 2 experts have been brought into the village. There is Birkin, who is a graduate of an art school, now specialising in exposing wall paintings. And there is Moon, another World War I veteran, who is an archaeologist, and he's there to look for the grave. And over the course of the weeks they're there, a beautiful, beautiful summer in a beautiful part of Yorkshire, Birkin, who arrives there with a twitch that he acquired at Passchendaele, who is really unhappy. His wife has left him for another man, but will probably bounce back. He's in a very difficult relationship. He's very twitchy, literally twitchy. Mm. And over the course of 6 weeks, he finds his joy in life. He finds a serenity, a pride in his workmanship. He acquires a group of friends. He falls in love. And then he leaves it all and gets on with his life again.
Yes.
And the thing is, this is a tiny book. Before we started this podcast, I said, does anybody know how long it is? And we all speculated, 40,000, 30,000. It's 20,000 words long and it's got everything,
Director actually did the math.
Yes.
Thank you, Lauren.
That's right. It's not only got wonderful characterisation.
I've read longer proposals.
Yes. It's not only got wonderful characterisation, it's... The writing is beautiful. The nature writing is beautiful. It's also got something which isn't written about very often. It's the work of experts. It's a craftsman.
Yes.
Doing something quite brilliantly and enjoying what he's doing. In fact, they're true craftsmen because Moon is exactly the same. It's got a slight mystery, a little bit of tension. It's solved at the end. It's
sexy.
It's a bit sexy. It's very funny in parts. It shows the social structure brilliantly in the 20s.
The work on the painting is like the rhythm of the
The
book,
work on the painting the is marvellous. And in fact, I was going to read a little bit because he's uncovering is he's... uncovering a judge, he thinks it's going to be a judgment anyway, because it's a painting that's on the arch of the church of the chancel. So it's a big triangular section of wall above the altar. And he thinks that that's generally a judgment. And he's right. He gets up on the scaffolding. He starts lifting the paint. And he says, as the first tinges of garment appeared, that prince of blues, ultramarine, ground from lapis lazuli, began to show. That really confirmed his class. He must have fiddled it from a monastic job. No village church could ever have run to such expense. But it was the head, the face, which set a seal on his quality. For my money, the Italian masters could have learned a thing or two from that head. This was no catalogue Christ, insufferably ethereal. This was a wintry hardliner. Justice, yes, there would be justice, but not mercy. That was writ large on each feature, for when, by the week's end, I reached his raised right hand, it had not been made perfect. It was still pierced. This was the Oxford beef Christ, uncompromising, no more threatening. This is my hand. This is what you did to me. And for this many shall suffer the torment, for thus it was with me. Moon saw this at once. He murmured. Wouldn't fancy being in the dock if he was the beak. And that's what his writing is like. He pops in the lines, doesn't he?
I love this book when I read it. Yeah. Such a great recommendation from you and from other people. John, you hadn't read it before, had
no,
you?
No, I mean, I'd pretended to. I'd read it, obviously. we all do. But I hadn't actually grappled with it. There's that great line I always like to use of Column to Beans, which is, have you read it? Yeah, yes, but not personally. So I had read it, but not personally. But now I've read it personally, I'm kind of evangelical about it because it was... You know, there are those chicken soup books. You always think, I want to get ill so I can read P.G. Wodehouse and not have anybody bother me. Well, this is kind of, if you wanted to give someone a book that made them, that sort of restored their faith in storytelling, in nature, in human, beautifully observed. I mean, the book is, all the relationships are beautifully observed. But it's also, it's got a kind of a warmth and a kindness in it, which is quite rare in fiction. I keep having to pinch myself. It was written in 1980. It's not like written in 1920.
Well, that's what I mean. He's there. He's writing as somebody looking back, but the stuff set in 1920 feels contemporary.
I think one of the I agree with you, Lisa. One of the reasons for that is that although, as John says, it's very warm, it's not sentimental. This is one of the great things. One of the great things about Carr as a writer, I think. But one of the reasons why I think A Month in the Country works and people tell one another about it is because it never feels soppy.
No.
It's quite steely.
Yes.
Especially the last couple of pages, which we won't read out or talk about.
No,
because we don't want to give the end away, but you know, that's not merely a brave thing for the character.
There are no car chases and nobody dies. So.
But it's not just a brave thing for the character to do. It's an incredibly brave thing for J.L. Carr, the author, to do. to leave the story where it is.
He uses a lovely phrase in the intro saying, feeling a tug at the heart. And that's why it's just, I feel all the way through that he's such a clever writer, he manages to do that.
Damn, does he use that phrase in the book?
Yeah.
Oh my God, I think I've used it in one of mine.
Really?
I came straight from there.
Listen, Evans, a tug at the heart.
Oh
yeah,
my God.
But also, it's worth saying that A Month in the Country was written towards the end of he was nearly 70 when he wrote this book. And his wife had been diagnosed with cancer in 1968, I think I'm right in saying, and they had lived with her cancer for 12 or 13 years. And I think she had either died or they knew she was very near the end when he wrote this book, which he wrote over the course of a few months. And looking at it again this week with that knowledge, there is something very moving about the sense that someone who is trying to come to terms with a long period of suffering and saying goodbye to it in a way which will give him peace. Mm. That seems, I make the autobiographical comparison because actually it's generally accepted that J.L. Carr's work is extremely autobiographical, even if you can't quite pin specific characters on him.
Yeah, he was always moving stuff around. He said that novel writing can be a cold-blooded business. So he sort of, you know, he used pretty much all the things that happened in his life in his fiction, but he moved them around into different books. But I love, and he said something I think is one of the most modest and brilliant things I've ever read a novelist say, but really all I've tried to do is tell a few people a story in the most appropriate way. It's just really...
And it is appropriate, even in terms of length. And thank God, his publisher was itself published.
Wow.
Ah, we'll get on to that. But thank God, a publisher didn't say to him, yes, it's awfully good, but it's very short. Can you sort of extend it a bit?
Yeah.
Because it's short, but it's perfect. And frankly, it makes the rest of us hold up our hands in despair. Because if you can do all that in 20,000, why did the rest of us bother to write 80,000?
It's the old line about, you know, I'm sorry I wrote you a long letter. I didn't have time to write you a short one.
There's also the thing with this book, which is really fascinating, which I hadn't appreciated, was that Carr had been given the wardenship of a medieval church near Kettering in the mid-1960s, which he fought to stop being bulldozed by the local ecclesiastical authorities for 10 years. And you can read this book as a way of trying to say, you know, ultimately he didn't quite succeed, but in fiction he's able to keep the building standing forever.
Yes.
You know, that's one of the other beauties of it, I think.
And he's very good within the book. He talks a couple of times about the medieval mind. Of course, he's uncovering a medieval wall painting. And he's wonderful about reaching back even further to the past and saying these people weren't like us. They lived in a different way. They thought in a different way. Their rhythms of life were different. And it's wonderful. God, he's so good.
Yeah, no, it's great. I'm just thinking of little funny bits. There's the vicar is the very few bad characters in the book, you know, but the vicar's a bit of he had a cold, cooped-up look. And it's, in fact, the vicar's wife, Mrs. Kitch, who he falls in love with. And it's all very tense, particularly towards the end. But the vicar, he says, the vicar describes him looking at him when he first meets him. And he's completely soaked to the skin and he's standing in a cold church. And the vicar's very, very cross about the whole thing of the wall painting anyway. He says, indeed, I looked to him like an unsuitable person, likely to indulge in unnatural activities, who, against his advice, had been unnecessarily hired to uncover a wall painting he didn't want to see, and the sooner I got it done and buzzed off back to sin-stricken London, the better.
but you know, what he does do, though, which is something that George Eliot does, is introduce an unlikable character and then tilt the prism so you see him in a different way. And at the end, the vicar reveals that he knows that Moon and Birkin have thought he was a fool, and Birkin feels very uncomfortable, and he says, because people one doesn't care for, even dislike, make most of us feel uneasy when they appeal against their sentence. And that uncomfortable feeling when you condemn someone or have a laugh at their expense is so tender and so true.
And he does a lovely, every now and then, a great little bit of philosophy. He says, our jobs are private fantasies, our disguises, the cloak we can creep inside to hide, which is pretty cool.
So I would like to say a bit about J.L. Carr, because I was really, I asked several of the people who recommended this book to me on Twitter, including a couple of writers, I said, well, I love this book. What other books by J.L. Carr would you recommend? And almost without exception, they said, oh, I don't know. I haven't read any other books by J.L. Carr. So this week I read his last novel, which is called Harpole and Foxborough, General Publisher. He published it in 1992. He self-published it at the age of 80. I bought a copy from him directly because he came into the shop in which I was working at that time, said, hello.
What, with like a sack of books?
Yeah. Said, hello, I'm J.L. Carr.
18.
Yes. Hello, I'm J.L. Carr. I said, yes, I've just seen your book reviewed in the Sunday paper. He said, yes, I'm just down in London for the day. I'm taking a few copies round to Branches of Waterstones. So I bought a copy from J.L. Carr himself, which is signed. Here it is, signed by J.L. Carr. And it sat on my shelf for 23 years until this Monday when I read it. And the thing which surprised me about it greatly was it is incredibly funny.
Yeah.
I was tweeting a few little bits of it this week, page to page. Incredibly funny. And so I read a couple of other pieces by Carr, also very funny, none of them quite like one another. And it's rather changed how I feel about A Month in the Country. I think A Month in the Country, we're tempted to look at and think, as you suggest, it's a perfect book. It has a beginning, middle and end. It's slightly sealed off.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, the more I read about Carr and by Carr, the more that you can see it's another bulletin from the place that he occupies and the place that he works in. You know, I think a lot of novelists do that thing, which is absolutely fine, where they will tell 8 stories in the same way.
Yes, that's very true.
J.L. Carr tells one story in 8 different ways in 8 different novels.
I think that's exactly right.
And the more of him I read, the deeper my appreciation for A Month in the Country gets, because I realise he's choosing to write in that way. You know, he has all these different registers available to him that you see in his other books, and he chooses not to use any of them, but just this one for this book. Oh. That's real writing.
Yes, yes,
you know,
yes,
that's real strength of purpose.
Mm. I also looked at, I read his... How Steeple's Cinderby Wanderers.
I did read that, won
the FA Cup. It's not really in the same league.
It's light, isn't it? But it's quite good fun. Yeah.
Yeah. It's about a non-league team winning the FA Cup. And he writes, obviously, he played non-league football. But I also discovered this hinterland of his that, very, you know, with my QI hat on, he did all these amazing maps with incredible drawings and facts and strange bits and pieces of history and a whole series of reference books, Carr's Dictionaries of Extraordinary English Cricketers, his Dictionary of English Queens, King's Wives, Paramours, Celebrated Handfast Spouses and Royal Changelings. So a handfast spouse was actually a prostitute, really, I think, or certainly a concubine. But when somebody said, why did you not call them concubines? You might have sold a few more copies. And he said, I cherish my father's memory. His father was a stern Methodist, which comes out in the Month in the Country.
There's a brilliant line, and there's a fantastic biography of Carr called The Last Englishman by Byron Rogers. And the last line of the book is fantastic. I thought it tells you everything you need to know about J.L. Carr. It's Jim Carr died on the 26th of February 1994, and the last day of his life was the only one in which he had not been fully conscious.
Oh, that's very good, isn't
that's
it?
Brilliant.
That is very good.
And
yep.
what we perhaps don't know about J.L. Carr is that he had lived a full life of experiences, including being a headmaster for 16 years, before he resigned at about the age of 46, 47, to, as John suggests, publish little books and draw maps. And then as a result of being a publisher, that's the thing that drove him into writing his own books. So his first novel is published when he's 50.
Fantastic.
He's 50 and he starts writing a series of novels, each of which is different to the previous one.
It's amazing. And he actually kind of made it work. I think they had he and his wife had a chunk of money that they very nearly exhausted. But then the business did start to sort of work. But I love this little thing he says about books, which I think is from Harpole and Foxborough. But he says, books concern printers, publishers, sales reps, booksellers, proofreaders, professors, illustrators, indexers, critics, text editors, literary editors, librarians, book reviewers, bookbinders, bookkeepers, translators, typographers, Oxfam fundraisers, whole university departments of soothsayers, manufacturers of thread and glue, auctioneers, lumberjacks, starving mice, wolves howling at the doors of authors of first novels, the post office's book-bashing machine minder, religious bonfire fuel suppliers, and libel lawyers. And that this army is billeted upon one man or one woman gnawing a pen is neither here nor there. That's just brilliant.
He also has these in his own editions of his books published by his publisher, the Quince Tree Press. He has this legend at the beginning, which is brilliant. This is a printing office, crossroads of civilization, refuge of all the arts against the ravages of time. From this place, words may fly abroad, not to perish as waves of sound, but fixed in time, not corrupted by the hurrying hand, but verified in proof. Friend, you are on safe ground. This is a printing office.
I looked at it from a slightly different perspective. I was looking at it to begin with when you
said... Is this your tenuous link time?
This is a tenuous link time.
You're all
so
it.
I was looking at it from a different perspective. It was, I looked at, you know, we're going to do this book this week, and I looked at his other books, and the first thing I noticed was that originally they were all published by different publishers. Now, what does that tell you about a man?
Yeah.
Well... In my experience, it tells me he perhaps was a bit of a handful.
Yeah,
I think it does. I mean, that's normally the case, isn't it? So I thought, well, if I'm going to do a tenuous link, maybe I'll try and make this one actually a little less tenuous. Maybe I could find the person that commissioned or that was the editor for A Month in the Country. And because of the wonders of the internet, I was able to do that. The thing that really kicked this off was discovering that the first edition of A Month in the Country was published by a company called the Harvester Press.
Ah, yes, the Harvester Press.
And I knew about the Harvester Press because I grew up in a very, very boring village in Sussex that bizarrely was actually the home of the Harvester Press. It has two literary claims to fame. The Harvester Press were based there, and Patrick Hamilton lived there for four days.
He did.
What is the name of this extraordinary literary shrine?
It's a literary shrine called Hassocks.
Excellent.
Which means...
Right?
Yeah, Nila. There was mention of the word Hassocks in the country.
At least twice.
That's a tenuous
connection.
Anyway, so
it's very good.
I got in touch with a guy that ran Harvester Press, and I spoke to him on the phone this afternoon. I said, how did you come about to end up with this book? It's a strange book for them because they were an academic publisher. And he said, well, we had a little fictionist, and I read a piece in the bookseller that Carr had written, which was complaining about publishers, saying they were all crooks and saying they never paid any money to their authors. And if he worked out the amount of time that he'd spent writing over the last few years, his hourly rate would have been, less than a shilling. So John Spears wrote to him after seeing this piece in the bookstore and said, oh, I thought that was really interesting. We're not crooks. Have you got anything we can publish? And a couple of days later, through the post, came a jiffy bag with the manuscript from Month in the Country.
God, that's an amazing story.
No, there was no letter in there.
That was the only one as well. I get very twitchy about manuscripts
I think it might have been because... So John Spears puts it on his pile of manuscripts to read at some point, doesn't kind of get round to it, and a week later there's a postcard from Carr, and it says, you've had the manuscript a week, can you send it back now? So he rang him up.
That's brilliant.
He rang him up and said, I'm really sorry I haven't read it yet, but I'll read it in the next couple of days, and then I'll let you know, and I'll send it back. And Carr said, no, you need to get back to me tomorrow. So luckily it was only 20,000 words, so he read it overnight, loved it, and made him an offer, at which point Carr said, oh, since we last spoke, I've got an agent. So you can't deal with me anymore. You need to deal with my agent at AP Watt. Now, luckily, Spears knew the agent at AP Watt, so he rang her up and did a deal with her. He did a deal with her, played £1,000, I think, for it.
Yes.
And then he gets another phone call from Carr who says, whatever you do, don't give any money to that bastard at AP Watt. I sacked him. So Spears says, okay, I'm sorry, but I've already done the contract. We've got to do the book with her. And their relationship kind of carried on in that way. He was apparently very irascible, was the word that John Spears described him.
So well, I was fascinated too. A Month in the Country was put into paperback by
Penguin.
And Carr's editor at Penguin was the now retired Tony Lacey, who was the editor of my first book, Tilting at Windmills. And I...
Available from all good books.
No, it isn't.
Available through
A-books. Given that A Month in the Country won the Guardian Fiction Prize
and was shortlisted for the Booker.
Tony
didn't take up the option for the following book, which is called The Battle of Pollock's Crossing. And I am...
He must have been really difficult.
I don't have confirmation of this, but yeah. Wow. I think the reason why he's published by even a publisher who would wish to hang on to it... And it's worth saying The Battle of Pollock's Crossing... also shortlisted for the Booker Prize.
Yeah, amazing.
So Spears, the guy from Harvester Press, he said that there was one man who championed the book, and it was this person championing the book that really got the ball rolling and started it selling copies. Can you guess who it was?
Give us a clue. Is it what field?
So he was one of the Booker judges, and he wrote also about rural life and about villages.
Was it Jack Hargreaves?
It was not Jack Hargreaves.
Ronald Blythe?
It was.
Oh,
you're right. Ronald Blythe, who was the first big champion for the book and really set it on its way.
The Harpole Report was championed by Frank Muir.
Was it really?
It really was.
That's right. You know, Frank Muir's book of the year.
It was Frank Muir's book of the year. It was J.L. Carr's big break. Yeah.
And also, apparently, so it was Peter Mayer at Penguin who picked the book up, and he was trying to get the paperback rights for everything on the Booker shortlist that year. And he picked them all up except for the one that won.
Which was what?
I think it was William...
William Golding.
Oh, it was Darkness Visible, wasn't it, that year, was it? Yeah, I think...
Cool. Can I read one just last little bit? Because I was trying to think of something that sums up. Because Birkin has been working on this painting for a couple of months and he's leaving. So I turned and climbed the ladder for a last look. And standing before the great spread of colour, I felt the old tingling excitement and a sureness that the time would come when some stranger would stand there too and understand. Just love that. It's just that he's done his work. That's what you were saying, Lisa, about craftsmanship.
Yep.
He's done his work.
Yes.
He looks, gives it a last look and thinks, somebody is going to be like me and will come and understand what's happened here. And I know that just seems to be sort of what all artists do, all writers do in a way. Leave stuff for other people to discover. And I think the work of J.L. Carr, we've had a fun week. Exploring it is everybody should dig in. There is literally something for everyone, I think, with J.L. Carr. Okay, I think that's it for this week. Thank you all very much for listening.
Thank you.
We'll be back in a fortnight's time to be discussing something else along the lines of what, Andy? Books, bookshops, more books, authors.
Life and fate. We're discussing life and fate.
Large, thick Russian novels.
Yeah,
or small books with not very many words in, like J.L. Carr. And I guess you can also follow us, Andy, can't you?
Yes, you can follow us on Facebook, Backlisted Podcast, or you can follow us on Twister. Twister. All come round here for Twister.
Lit Twister.
You can follow us on Twitter at Backlisted Pod. You can choose to listen to Backlisted with or without adverts. If you prefer to listen to it without adverts, you can join us on our Patreon at patreon.com/backlisted, where you also get bonus content of 2 episodes of Locklisted, the podcast where we talk about the books and films and music that we've been listening to over the last couple of weeks.